The United States has had two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth, which is the standard definition of economic recession. However, in an effort to avoid the negative press the recession label receives, the administration of President Joe Biden claimed that a stable unemployment rate meant that the U.S. was not in a recession. That's no longer possible. Due to the so-called Uberization of the United States economy, the official data has long been accused of falsely portraying a rosy picture. The national unemployment rate is 4%, but many say the jobs available are part-time, or lack crucial benefits like health care, or are poorly paid despite the current record inflation.
People looking for benefits, they want to work from home. People are not settling like they used to. It's just a matter of, I don't want to say laziness, but I think people are just, they're trying to get the best that they want, and companies are trying to hold steady and their wages, and they're not willing to pay as much because costs are going up for them as well.
Amid the backfiring of Western sanctions on Russia, many businesses have responded by cutting job listings, slowing the hiring process, and may begin mass layoffs.
Now we've got the threat of recession, so some employers are cutting back on their hiring. My son-in-law just had to fire several people he had who were hiring people. So they're cutting back on their hiring process based on a precautionary measure, thinking there might be a recession.
The widespread perception is that America's central bank is forcing a recession to reduce inflation, even if that means throwing millions out of work, out of their homes, and guts pensions, which are usually based on the stock market. The drop in jobs is the latest piece of data which shows a dangerously worsening economic situation for the average American. Wages are losing ground to inflation at a record pace, and an economically chaotic October could translate into a painful holiday season for many. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Thousands of Palestinians have rallied in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the 35th anniversary of the outset of the Islamic Jihad movement. People from all walks of life joined to show their support. The Islamic Jihad movement is highly respected by all Palestinian factions and has always been a uniting factor among them. The movement was founded by the late Dr. Fathi Shaqaqi, who was inspired by the Iranian Revolution and the teachings of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini.
Today we pay tribute to our founder Fathi Shaqaqi and all the martyrs. Our path is a very long one and paved by the blood of martyrs who sacrificed their lives for the sake of Islam and for the sake of Al-Quds.
Ziad Al-Nakhala, the Secretary General of Islamic Jihad, addressed the attendees via satellite link. During his speech, Al-Nakhala stressed the unity among all Palestinian factions and praised the axis of resistance against the Israeli regime.
Gaza is part of the axis of resistance, and this rally stresses that armed resistance is the key to the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. People attending this event are affirming their allegiance to the resistance and to the Islamic Jihad movement.
The Islamic Jihad movement and its leaders remain blacklisted by the European Union and the United States for refusing to recognize the Israeli regime.
We are all here to support the resistance against the Zionist regime. Our people are sending a strong message to the whole world today about their unwavering support for the resistance. We will continue our struggle until the liberation of Al-Quds.
Islamic Jihad supporters want the Israeli regime to know that their movement is a force to be reckoned with.
35 years on, the popularity of the Islamic Jihad movement continues to grow due to the movement's strict adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
British police have released images of individuals they want to identify in connection with the recent anti-Iran riots opposite Iran's embassy in London. The London Metropolitan Police have already admitted that five officers were seriously injured during clashes with demonstrators on September the 25th. The protesters claimed to support Iranian woman Marza Amini, who collapsed at a police station in Tehran on September the 16th. A spokesperson for the Met said,
"We won't tolerate members of the public or officers who are doing all they can to maintain and regain order being injured in any circumstances. And we are now doing everything we can to make sure those who committed the violent offences are brought to justice."
Police are now guarding the embassy and consulate building, but other sites remain fearful of future attacks too. The Islamic Centre of England in Maida Vale was also targeted in the recent riots.
There's been so many cases where these so-called Iranians, these, you know, pro-Iranians have come and they've ripped off women's hijabs and they've beat up little girls and they've smashed in people's heads. It's just ridiculous.
The recent protests saw a hodgepodge of rival ideologies and dissident groups banding together. Many of these groups have a history of conducting violent attacks against Iranian expats living in the West. We witnessed supporters of the anti-Iran terrorist group, the MKO, and former Shah dictatorship supporters verbally and physically assaulting Iranians attempting to vote in London back in June 2021.
I heard a rock hit the ground. I didn't look back because I was shaking at that time as well. And it hit my trainer, bit of it. And then they're calling names. One of them said to me, and funnily enough, the policeman was there, but obviously you couldn't understand Farsi. He's telling me if I had a knife, I would cut you in pieces right here, right now.
Calm has returned to London streets for the time being. However, many of the dissident groups which took part in the recent riots remain active and at large, acting as opportunists, willing to jump on any opportunity to harass ordinary Iranian expats and seemingly anyone else who stands in their way. Robert Carter, London.
On Wednesday, Italy's largest retailers association, Confcommercio, warned that over 120,000 small businesses risk shutting down in the first half of 2023. The association said firms are squeezed by the cost of living and skyrocketing energy prices. The president of Confcommercio, Carlo Sangalli, urged the government to do more to shield small and medium entrepreneurs, as the situation for many is now very critical.
There is the risk of a high number of business closures in the coming 9 months. Some small firms will simply find it more convenient to suspend their activity rather than losing 200 to 300 euros a day. Having said that, Italy will soon face a mild recession, which frankly is not as worrying as the media depict it.
Last month, Italy's outgoing government approved an aid package worth some 14 billion euros in an attempt to shield firms and families from surging energy costs. The measure came on top of over 50 billion euros already budgeted since January to soften the energy crisis in the country. However, the aid seems to be insufficient as an increasing number of businesses are struggling to stay afloat.
Everything costs at least 20% more. Energy prices keep soaring and it is very hard to keep going. We need help. The government must do something.
I cannot afford paying expenses for my family. I have four dependent children. They're all unemployed. Bills keep going up. How do we cope?
According to Confcommercio, more than 370,000 jobs are at risk as a result of the energy crisis. Meanwhile, energy giant Eni announced that gas supplies to Italy from Russia have resumed after 4 days. Russia's state-controlled Gazprom cut off gas supplies to Italy on Saturday, citing a problem linked to regulatory changes in Austria. Italy's national energy regulator, ARERA, warned last week that prices would climb by almost 60% by the end of the year, but experts argue that its estimate was optimistic. Bills have risen by 93% in Italy over the past 2 years, and the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, together with the damage recently sustained by Nord Stream pipelines, is likely to push costs even higher. Max Civili, Rome.
Back on October 3, 2015, this Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz was reduced to rubble after being hit by a U.S. deadly airstrike. 211 shells were fired in the strike, lasting almost 1 hour. The charity hospital later announced that 42 civilians, including staffers and patients, were killed, and dozens of others were wounded.
Throughout the NATO coalition presence in Afghanistan, there were a lot of blind air strikes and rights violations against Afghan civilians, especially by American air forces. The 2015 attack on Kunduz Charity Hospital was one of those atrocities and the biggest of its kind. As I remember, it was so deadly and devastating. Hospitals in war zones are protected under the Fourth Geneva Convention, and attacks on them should be tried as a war crime.
After initially denying the building being targeted, the U.S. eventually claimed responsibility for the airstrikes, justifying that it had been a serious and tragic mistake.
Independently and impartially.
The MSF called it a breach of international humanitarian law and a war crime, demanding for an independent probe. But an independent investigation or trial has never been conducted against the U.S. forces' atrocities.
The MSF and rights bodies believe that the U.S. deadly air raid on Charity Hospital could be prosecuted as a war crime, but the international courts and bodies failed to conduct a trial because they are controlled by arrogant powers. They are funded by those countries and obey them. Besides, the U.S. has never agreed to turn any of their service members over to an outside judicial body. As a result, the case of the Kunduz attack was shot by Washington with a mere discipline of some American personnel, and no one was criminally charged.
Throughout the two-decade U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, there had been more than 13,000 airstrikes conducted by American forces in the country. The U.S. drone war on Afghanistan killed more than 4,000 people, including women and children. The U.S. airstrike on the Charity Hospital in Kunduz is one of the many instances of American forces' atrocities on Afghan soil. People here say the U.S. should be held accountable for crimes it has committed in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Muslims in London were compelled to mobilize outside an Islamic center on Saturday following recent Islamophobic violence by anti-Iran protesters. On Sunday, the 25th of September, London witnessed an outpouring of anti-Muslim attacks as protesters claiming to support Mirza Amini were filmed attacking Shia Muslims commemorating Arba'in and the Iranian Islamic Center of England, following clashes with police outside Iran's embassy.
Last week, our mosque was attacked. Our procession was attacked. People were attacked that weren't even Iranian, had nothing, they didn't know anything about what was going on. And it impedes our freedom of religion in this country.
Protests over the death of Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian woman who fell to the floor at a police station on September the 16th, started shortly after her death was announced. Those protests soon turned into violent riots, with masked people attacking security officers, resorting to vandalism and desecrating religious sanctities, including hijab burnings. Dissident groups outside of Iran were quick to board the bandwagon, engaging in violent protests throughout Europe, especially in London and Paris.
We've got people not of an Iranian origin, but in fact of multinational origin who've come out here to direct their anger to these people who are loaded with anti-Islamic people, LGBT people, and all elements which are anti-Islam who have come out here to side with an event which has happened in Iran. But really, they don't care about that event.
A police presence remains outside the Islamic Center, that groups are continuing to target the site.
Saturday's demonstration passed by peacefully without any major incidents occurring. However, locals informed me that they remained deeply concerned that future attacks may take place. They also informed me that they were deeply frustrated at the local authorities who failed to protect the community. Robert Carter, London.
In the limelight.
Statistics and studies show the number of cases of violence with firearms in the United States has increased in recent years, especially since 2020. As gun violence ramped up during the coronavirus pandemic in America, cities also saw homicide rates rise. And that trend continued in 2021 in many of the nation's most populous cities. The American people are the most armed citizens in the world, and this estimate from the 2021 National Firearms Survey shows that about two-thirds of American adults own a gun. In this regard, we have taken a close look at some of world press and news agencies to shed more light on this matter. Please stay with us. Over the weekend, at least 9 people were killed and 48 wounded in multiple shootings in different parts of the United States. The U.S. Gun Violence Archive says more than 30,000 people have died from gun violence in the United States so far this year. According to CGTN website, in Norfolk, Virginia, police say 2 people were killed and 5 others injured by gunfire at a party on Sunday, 4th of September. On the same day, at least 6 people were injured in a shooting incident in downtown Charleston, South Carolina. In Maryland, a 15-year-old teenage boy was killed and 3 other people injured after 2 gunmen opened fire on Saturday, 3rd of September, inside a convenience store. From Friday, 2nd of September, to Sunday, 4th of September, the city of Chicago in Illinois reported a number of shootings that left 6 people dead and 34 others injured. Last year was the deadliest for the city of Chicago in 25 years, with nearly 800 homicides recorded. The News Times Daily explains more about the story, saying, "Gun and violence have become ubiquitous words. It is appalling. America is known from abroad to have a culture in which the procurement and ownership of guns lead to the pervasive killing of students, worshippers, and innocent bystanders, causing premature death in thousands of people. In the face of this prevalence, gun violence is declared a public health crisis, an epidemic of evil, with hand weapons being the instruments. Every tragic and sorrowful shooting prompts governmental action, followed by disagreements and inaction. Citizens are acting instead. Some activists want an office of gun prevention. Some communities are establishing community intervention programs, starting with young people who are on both ends of the gun, as drivers and victims of violence. U.S. Congress passed the first major gun safety legislation in years. However, even the National Rifle Association, the NRA, stated, "It does little to address violent crime." Sure, access to fewer guns by fewer people means fewer deaths, but gun violence is not going away. With so many guns already in circulation, hundreds of gun laws written and not passed by Congress, and the pressure of the gun lobby make enforcement of the new act questionable, about reducing gun incidents. If using hand weapons is of epidemic proportions, efforts to mitigate it are essential. It means getting to the root of why crimes are committed in the first place. Those committing shootings that have been determined to be impulsive and immature youths and adults with problem histories, all who found ease in purchasing guns. Warning signs were there. Bullying and being bullied. Depression, adverse childhood experiences, stress at home, and an interest in violence and hatred. If these markers are identified, individuals can be assessed and managed as early as possible. Researchers about gun violence prevention can use data to identify potential threatening people. The Minnesota Reformer writes, in a country where there are more firearms than people, mass shooting incidents have become increasingly frequent, and gun violence in general is on the rise. More Americans died from gun violence in 2020, the most recent year for which there is data, than any other year on record, and gun violence was the number one cause of death for children in 2020. In the past year, the country has grappled with an onslaught of mass shooting incidents, from a 15-year-old boy shooting and killing four students and wounding seven others at Oxford High School in southeast Michigan, a gunman killing seven people and wounding dozens more during a 4th of July celebration in Highland Park, Illinois, another gunman killing 19 children and two teachers in Uvalde, Texas, the deadliest mass shooting in 2022, and a gunman and avowed white supremacist shooting and killing 10 people at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York. Amidst this terror, experts are grappling with why this is happening. The answer is that it is layered. There's the fact that guns are ubiquitous in the United States. In a country of about 330 million people, gun owners possess about 393.3 million weapons. And gun ownership soared during the coronavirus pandemic. The current gun violence crisis comes at a time when gun ownership soared during the pandemic and the number of white nationalist groups jumped by 55% during the Donald Trump presidency. Experts say there are a lot of guns and a lot of anger, much of which is fueled by white supremacy that spreads like a wildfire because of social media in the country right now. Following the shooting incident at Oxford High School, U.S. Democratic lawmakers called on their Republican colleagues to act on legislation meant to curb gun violence, including Senate bills 550, 553, and House bills 5066 and 5069, which would require gun owners to store firearms that could be accessed by minors and children in a locked box or other secure location. Other bills, including bipartisan and bicameral legislation, Senate Bills 678, 679, and House Bills 5371 and 5372, would prohibit individuals convicted of domestic violence, misdemeanor, from owning a gun or ammunition until 8 years after they have paid any fines and completed their jail term or probation terms. None of these bills have received a hearing. CNN's website elaborates more on the issue, saying, gun violence is rampant in the United States, according to Gun Violence Archive. There have been at least 456 mass shooting incidents in 2022, leaving 30,237 people dead. That's an average of more than 1.8 mass shootings every day so far. The 2018 Small Arms Survey found that there were approximately 393 million firearms in civilian hands in the country, or 120.5 firearms per 100 people. That number is much higher now, given the soaring increase in gun sales in the past few years. U.S. President Joe Biden in July said that a flood of guns was turning American communities into killing fields and vowed to reinstate a ban on assault rifles. The remarks came in a White House ceremony to mark new gun control legislation that he signed on 25th of June. President Biden said, "This has taken too long, with too much of a trail of bloodshed and carnage. The past many years, across our schools, places of worship, workplaces, stores, music festivals, nightclubs, and so many other everyday places, they have turned into killing fields." A group of parents and family members who lost their loved ones in the Uvalde school shooting incident joined gun safety advocates outside the Texas governor's mansion in Austin, Texas, recently, pleading for Governor Greg Abbott to move to raise the minimum age to purchase an assault rifle, AR-15-style rifles. With schools across Texas having already welcomed students back into the classroom, gun safety advocates are calling for the governor to hold a special legislative session so state lawmakers can vote on whether to raise the minimum age for purchasing AR-15-style rifles from 18 to 21 years old. The Texas governor, Greg Abbott, has repeatedly said he would not do so. Abbott has claimed that mental health is at the core of America's gun violence epidemic, not firearms themselves. One of those parents say mental health is part of the problem, but that refusing to acknowledge that guns play a part as well is ridiculous.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
the spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on NATO to launch preventive strikes on Russian soil, drawing a furious response from Moscow. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov called the remarks an appeal to start yet another world war with unpredictable and monstrous consequences. Russian President Vladimir Putin had previously warned the West that Russia would use all available means to respond to threats against its territorial integrity. Moscow says now the need for its operation in Ukraine is highlighted even more. Well, as Putin has accused Western countries of engaging in nuclear blackmail and trying to destroy Russia, a recent report claims that U.S. special forces are on the ground in Ukraine as part of a broad clandestine operation, which includes the CIA. Joining us on Spotlight, we have International Action Center Sarah Flounders joining us from New York. And activist and commentator Don DeBar joining us from Austin, New York as well.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Ms. Flounders. According to a recent report, U.S. Special Operations Forces are on the ground in Ukraine, citing unnamed U.S. intelligence and military officials. The report says this presence is part of a broad clandestine operation that includes the CIA. What is the purpose of this presence, in your opinion?
Well, this broad CIA Special Forces operation has been going on for years, since the 2014 coup that was orchestrated by the U.S. to overthrow the elected government in Ukraine. And it has been nonstop. U.S. military contractors, trainers, CIA forces, special forces, NATO forces from other countries, have been intensely involved in propping up the Ukrainian government, militarizing it start to finish, and shipping in an enormous quantity of weapons and then trainers and handling those weapons. This has been a big, big operation, and it's all pointed at how to break Russia's relations with the EU through sanctions and military means. And really to utilize Ukrainian forces to do the fighting and dying and the complete destruction of their economy, and also to bring down, it's really brought down the economies of Europe.
Don DeBar, the report says U.S. clandestine operations inside Ukraine are, quote, now far more extensive than they were early in the war, when U.S. intelligence officials were fearful that Russia would steamroll over the Ukrainian army. Give us your thoughts on this report initially, and is this just what the U.S. and NATO wanted all along, for this conflict to be a prolonged one and to see it dragged out for as long as possible in hopes that it weakens Russia?
Well, certainly the goal of U.S. foreign policy is to not just weaken Russia, but to topple the government and break it into the nation state into several constituent pieces that they can control so they can loot the natural resources and more or less exploit the human resources as deeply as possible. And if you look around the world for other examples, you can see that that's pretty deep. Resources on the ground were there long before the coup in 2014. Those are the forces that engineered the coup in 2014. Victoria Nuland is, on video bragging shortly after the coup d'etat that they had spent previously $5 billion and essentially preparing for the coup. They had built infrastructure, communications, radio stations, television stations, printing presses, all things that were used to propagandize essentially an ideology that led to the division of the country, exacerbating the existing divisions that you could see on an election map, for example, the 2010 election, to the point where it became violent and the nation state was broken up. The goal of the U.S. in Ukraine has been to position military hardware there, to create chaos where they couldn't dominate it, to terrorize the Russian people with actual Nazis. I mean, the collective memory of Russia is of Nazis is of 30 million Russians and other Soviets being killed in World War II. And that if chaos reigns there, fine. If there's an extended war, fine, because the military-industrial complex makes money. It's also this whole conflict has been weaponized against Europe. Certainly Germany will not rise and the EU will not rise as against the people who, the construct that belongs to the people who run the United States, since they can't even get gasoline to power their factories. It's a win-win-win for the elite in the United States, and it's a lose for everybody else. We may end up with a nuclear war, and we can talk about that some over the course of this program if you'd like. We may end up with an extended brushfire war like we used to see in Asia back in the 60s. No matter what it is, the elite here thinks that they're going to win. If we end up with a nuclear war, however, that will be shown to be a delusion, and it will be one, unfortunately, that we will share the consequences of if we don't stop it.
Sarah Flanders, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, as we mentioned in the intro, has called on NATO to launch preventive strikes on Russian soil. Those comments drew a furious response from the Kremlin spokesman, who called the remarks an appeal to start yet another world war with unpredictable and monstrous consequences. What is your perspective on the recent comments from the Ukrainian president?
Well, first of all, Ukraine has absolutely no independence. They are just a proxy puppet force for U.S. war plans. And the quotes and statements that they make, really are vetted through the U.S. So it's a new level of threats, an extremely dangerous level of threats. But it is this political force in the Ukraine is a U.S. creation, and it shows a dangerous escalation of one threat after another. Could this lead to wider war? It certainly could. And creating that anxiety and fear is part of U.S. strategy, whether it is the destruction of Nord Stream 1 and 2 or constantly moving more and more forces, higher range of equipment, or in the political statements. So I really see this as a new threat coming from U.S., and they're not doing so well in this war. And so how do they keep upping the ante? Dragging it out, dragging more forces into it, and further, as I say, complete destruction of Ukraine and also of Europe itself. So it's dangerous, and it does show that the U.S. Is more determined than ever to drag this war out and escalate it.
Don DeBar, Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned the West that Moscow would use all available means to respond to threats against its territorial integrity. How do you read into these warnings, and how seriously should they be taken?
Well, they should be taken very seriously. But what's happening, in essence, is a statement for the world to understand of Russia's strategic military policy. On the one hand, the United States is conducting, it's not just a proxy war, as we're learning, There have been U.S. military assets on the ground since 2014 and probably earlier. There was a document signed by Obama enabling military assets to be placed there back when he was president, and this was in 2014. So we're actually at war with Russia. Russia knows it, okay? The Pentagon and Langley know it. The only people who don't know it really are the American people. The statement by President Putin was, in essence, this is the pair of conditions under which we would contemplate the use of or use nuclear weapons. Number one, if they're used against us, clear enough, that's the mutually assured destruction statement. Number two, if our state is under existential threat, in other words, if someone is going to take down the Russian government, we're going to use all the weapons that we have at our disposal to prevent that. That's why we have a military. Now, the United States claims that that's why it has a military. It has a budget as large as the next nine countries combined, including Russia, which is three nations down the list from the U.S. And yet, the United States doctrine requires the placement of 800 military bases around the world, at Russia's borders, at China's borders, constant drilling and wargaming at the borders of these countries. And so for Russia to say, if you're going to take our government down, as you say you are doing while you are moving military assets around our borders, we're telling you we're not going to allow it to happen. And there's one last point to keep in mind here. Even if Russia allowed what happened in 1991, which is sort of the dream of the people in Langley right now, to happen again, in other words, even if by sanctions and military activity draining the morale of the country and all of that, they were able to effect instability in the government where the government might fall. The Russian government cannot fall this time. The Russian people will not sit for it because they remember the 1990s and they will not go back there. If they force the existing government down in Russia, the Russian people will demand someone more militant and more militaristic to fight a war with the United States. This is a very dangerous game that's being played here.
Sarah Founders, Russia has time and again said countries supplying weapons to Ukraine and training its soldiers were in fact parties to the conflict. The question is, will this support result in this conflict spilling over into other regions and possibly turning into something bigger?
Well, that is certainly the effort, the attempt by the U.S. Wider war, endless war, endless military budget, endless military profits in a decaying, dying system that is unable to provide for people's needs right here in the U.S. or anywhere else in the world. So they have every interest in widening the war, in engaging other countries among the states of the former Soviet Union, in threatening China in new and really dangerous ways, and all while continuing the wars in Syria. They still have troops in Iraq, threats on Iran, threats against Cuba, Venezuela. We could just look around the world. The U.S. plan is for wider war, new threats, and creating everywhere they can real instability. Anywhere that economically or militarily they can upend a country, they're all for doing it. And it's a very dangerous policy that creates more and more instability around the world. And yet at the same time, I would say the entire global South has refused to accept the sanctions and is more and more trading and exchanging and connecting with each other in ways that are unprecedented, historically unprecedented. So it is more isolating for the U.S. and its NATO partners than at any time in history before this. It used to be they called the shots. That's how, and they're used to functioning in that way. They would declare a country sanctioned. They would declare that they were taking down a country, and the world stood by. That's not happening in this war, and that is a new development. Now, how the U.S. responds with more threats, more efforts to widen the war, But the cohesion among countries that are refusing to accept this is also growing apace much faster than we have ever seen it. And it's a needed response because every one of these countries now knows they got to cooperate with each other or they will be taken apart.
Mr. DeBar, Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces have retaken some areas in the southern Kherson region. Now, Kherson is one of the areas which was recently declared by Vladimir Putin to be part of Russia. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has promised that these areas recaptured by Kiev will eventually return to Russia. Looking at these developments on the ground, what does this mean overall for the conflict, in your opinion?
People treat war generally, and this war at the moment, as if it were a football contest or some other thing where it's an emotional tug of war that goes back and forth. The United States conducts war lately, say since 1990. You shock and awe, you bomb a place into oblivion, and then as the troops and everybody else escape from the inferno, you pick them off from helicopters and, you know, with mortars and everything else, and you level the place. And then you try to occupy it for 10, 20, 30 years, as in Afghanistan, Iraq, et cetera. And so the end of the football game comes rather quickly, 30 days, 60 days, whatever. In other words, everything's obliterated within a short period of time, and that is mission accomplished. Russia, number one, first of all, isn't conducting this war halfway around the world with people that are strangers that they're trying to dominate. These are their brothers. They were part of the same nation state on and off for the last 500 years. The families live on both sides of those borders in the same way the families live on the borders between New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania and Connecticut. And so the idea of going in and obliterating Ukraine, which Russia could do with one squadron of planes in an hour and a half, it doesn't occur to them. And further than that, they understand that when this war or whatever this ends up being is over, they're still going to be neighbors. They're still going to have to do business together. They still are going to have families on both sides of the border and all of these things. And so their approach has been something different, and their mission is something different. Their mission was to remove a military threat by the West on their border and to remove this influence that was stoked by the United States over a period from World War II, really, up until and through the coup and to the present. Of this Nazi ideology. That looks here like their plan to conquer Ukraine is failing and that they're being reversed. And it's being portrayed that way in the propaganda. But in fact, what's happening is Russia is on game. They're playing chess. They're not playing football. It's a long game. And if you look at a map of the 2010 presidential election in Ukraine and look at a map of the referendum last week or 2 weeks ago in the four in the four republics, you'll see that actually support for joining Russia covers a piece of real estate about three times that's been voted on so far. And these little pieces of territory that are being ceded back and forth to avoid major conflicts in populated areas are all full of people that would rather be in Russia than Ukraine. And over time, that's what's going to happen. The question is, how much is the United States going to stoke destruction before that happens? And the real question is, how long are we going to allow this to go on? Because they're spending our money that we need for food, gasoline, medical care, and education at a higher rate than they've spent it on anything in the last 50 years. And we're sitting around fighting over Roe v. Wade and rainbow flags and
sure,
other things that are important but not nearly as consequential as World War III is going to turn out to be if we let that happen.
Sarah Flounders, in light of the recent developments on the ground, how do you view the prospects for an end to this war?
I really think that the U.S. will again and again block every effort of negotiations. However, as we learned from Afghanistan, wars end. And they end by, and they're hard fought. It's at a great loss of life, but where the U.S. can no longer continue with the forces that it has created to continue the war. Now, the Ukrainian military is coming apart. Its losses are enormous. Its losses of equipment is rather spectacular. Even greater than its losses of equipment in war is the amount of equipment that simply gets resold. I mean, the amount of war profiteering that goes on in Ukraine, huge shipments literally disappear within a mile over the border into Ukraine. There's a huge reselling of equipment and a vast amount of corruption. So the Ukrainian military will come apart and is coming apart. The loss of life is horrendous, but I don't think this war can continue, especially into the winter, regardless of how long the U.S. wants it to continue and is willing to send the trainers. That doesn't mean they will have the army that they hope to have. And they have, the U.S. does keep pumping in, as these recent articles show, special forces, CIA agents, contractors, but they're not the bulk of the army. You need Ukrainian forces for that, and you need equipment and the training to use the equipment, and that is what is coming apart. On the other hand, Russia is more determined than ever before. These areas are now part of Russia, and that changes even the military doctrines. So I don't think this war can continue in Ukraine. Doesn't mean the U.S. will stop at other efforts or that they won't quickly move on to China, Iran, or some part of the former Soviet republics, because they have other plans. But in the Ukraine, I think it will reach its limit in the inability of the Ukrainian military to respond. And we can see that happening now.
And Adan Dabar, one last question for you. We have about a minute left. Why did NATO continue to exist following the collapse of the Soviet Union and at the end of the Cold War? Why? What is the purpose, basically, of NATO today as we speak?
Well, for exactly what you're seeing. The purpose of NATO is to conquer Russia. That it was always that. And what you're going to see happen instead, as they try to induce instability inside Russia and some of the other allies of Russia, what they're actually doing is inducing instability in Europe. And if they don't solve this problem in Ukraine within the next couple of weeks, you may well see revolutions in Germany, France, Italy, and a number of other places, Czech Republic for sure, as a consequence of this adventure. And so, you know, they may think that they are working on Plan A, but Plan B may rear its head and provide a surprise for everyone, October or maybe later surprise.
All right.